John Thompson is a retired fisherman and a lifelong resident of Dipper Harbor, New Brunswick. His ancestors played a part in establishing a traditional and viable lifestyle in this fishing community. John will share some of his memories of the past and his feeling for the sea. The narrator is John Thompson. The date is February 26, 1976. The interviewer is Ethel Thompson. How old are you, John?
I'm 70.
And where were you born?
Born here in Dipper Harbor.
Have you always lived in Dipper Harbor?
Yes.
Did your father live here?
Yes, he lived here from he was married anyway. He came from Little Mushquash. I suppose that's where he was born. I'm not sure of that.
Did he build the house he came to?
I wouldn't say for sure. He bought the place here, and I believe the house, I think, was on it at that time.
And what did he do for a living?
He fished for a living.
What kind of fishing?
Well, most every kind. That is salmon and codfish, haddock, lobster, sardines.
Did he like to lobster fish?
He didn't seem to like lobster fishing as well as he did the other.
Do you like lobster fishing?
Well, I would say I did. The lobster fishing is one of the best that there is, most money in. But the other is more exciting or something, because you never know from one day to the next just which you're going to do. Same quantity of fish, it varies. From a small catch to a medium size or very good fishing or something like that.
And what did they do with their fish?
Well, they salted the line fish mostly all at in the early years. When I first started, there wasn't too much fresh fish. There was no freezers or anything then, and the fresh fish had to be taken to market, and they had no way of keeping them only with ice.
Then did someone set up a fish stand here?
There was in two fish stands, Mr. O'Donnell and Elliot's brothers from Nova Scotia at fish stands here in my time. They salted them hake, and they went, they were shipped to West Indian market then.
Did the fishermen from Chance Harbor and Mesa Bay bring their catches here too?
Quite a lot. Mesa's Bay, they fished out of here, some of them, and Chance Harbor, they would come in here. In Chance Harbor, there was a fish stand too. Mr. Belding, Jess Belding, had a fish stand there that I remember of. Then if the fishing was... Well, good fishing. Some years when I first started that, there would be a lot of fish brought in one day. And some of the boats, there'd be too many at one place, and they would have to go to the other fish stand with them, and back and forth like that. And Captain John Snow from Digby came over here, and he had a large vessel, and he stayed here, and they fished, he brought probably five men with them, and they fished, and when they got the vessel loaded with fish, they went, took them back, and then they'd come back and probably fish another spell.
They salted the
they
fish?
They salted them right in the hull of the boat.
Was this before the Depression?
Oh yes, that was in the teens, in 1912 to probably 1920, in the First World War.
Yeah.
It was a good market for fish then.
And then when the Depression came, how did people make a living here?
Well, they had nothing else they could do. They had to keep on fishing, but there was nothing else to turn to. And it was quite a more or less of a struggle for a few years there. And it was the same, I guess, all over Canada. No matter what your job was, you were lucky to have a job or make a living.
Did you do anything special at that time?
Well, you just carried on with the different kinds of fishing.
Did you go to Grand Manan?
We went to Grand Manan, again fished out of there for about a month, drove herring, and that called it driving herring. You had you soaked a 5 gallon can we generally used with cotton bats and kerosene, and then you had a torch on the boat. We made a wire net with a handle out so it would be 2 or 3 feet out from the boat, and then herring would come up with that light, and we'd dip with a dip net, which was quite a large net. It would hold up to 5 or 6 barrels of herring, and we would drive there for, well, maybe 4 or 5 hours till the market was taken up, and then we'd have to quit and do that. If the weather allowed, we keep on every night. That was weather allowed us to. Well, we made a living, but nothing great, because the sardine then was cheap to what they are today, $10 a hogshead, and we had we had quite a lot of fun. At the same time, it wasn't all dull. And we was over there, and we got kind of lonesome to come back home. It was myself and brother and Willie Thompson and Cecil Clark, all from Dipper here, and we thought we'd come home for the weekend, and we got caught in a storm, and we was thick fog and blowing a hard easterly wind, which was a headwind for us to come home, and we were afraid to go back once we started, that we couldn't find the horn or the harbor, so we come over to the what we call the North Shore, thought we'd come over and get into Beaver Harbor or Black's Harbor. And we did that, and we had quite a struggle that day. And we finally got into Bliss's Island, the lower end of it, which is down below Black's mile or so. That finally we got up into Black's Harbor, and I went to the store to get some provisions, and one of the clerks at the store wanted to know if I was John Thompson, and I said yes I was. And Well, he said, you're the man then that Douglas James has been worried about, and he knew that you left Grandma Nan this morning, and he has called here twice to know if knew anything about you, so you better go call your home and tell them where you are. So I done that, and my mother then, I wasn't married, and my mother was quite worried, and that relieved that situation, and the next day was fine, so we come up home. But we went back and then again the first of the week and continued on with that work until the market was over. Then the wearmen started to build their wares, and naturally the sardine market, they'd sooner have the fish from the wares than from us fellas. So we come home, and that ended that.
Would there be a difference in quality of the fish that was driven and the fish that was
Well, the fish that was driven, and they were handled more and inclined to be softer. And but at the time, they were awful anxious to get the fish and keep their factory going, and they didn't have much choice. But the fish that's caught in a weir or in a seine are the best fish because they're not handled so much.
What factory?
Well, that was Connor's brothers at Black's Harbor that was getting them fish then.
Was the price fairly good at that time?
Well, for Depression years, it wasn't so bad. If I remember right, we got $10 for those fish at that time.
The same from the weir as you do for the dragon?
Yes, they were the same then, but there was times when the fish got plenty in the summer and everybody had fish and the market wasn't large enough to handle supply, and I have sold herring for $3 a hogshead out of the wares out here the harbor, and lucky to be able to sell them at that. And one year, in particular, we sold the fish for $3 for fox feed, and all that the truck could handle a day was all you could sell, which was about 8 or 10 hogs of fish. They had to be bagged and hauled to St. John and put in the cold storage, and it was just a matter of something to do, and made no money, but they paid the expenses and got by. And later on, if you were lucky, you would get a sardine boat and be able to sell probably for $5 a hogshead. That's the way we carried on till the Depression years got over.
What ended the Depression years, John?
The Depression years? The 1929 was the crash of the stock market, and then we didn't feel the effects of it for probably 2 years. But it lasted, I would say, mostly to the 30s.
Until the war started?
Yes, 39. In 39, it started to pick up when the Second World War was declared. And it started to pick up the price. And from that on, it got better each year, seemingly. And he went back, I went back with my brother tending a sardine ware here in the war years, thought it was pretty good then because we started to get $10-$12 a hog for the fish, which was all right because the money then, $10 was true value of, but right now that $10 wouldn't be worth any more than half of what it was then.
Do you remember when the first breakwater was built?
No,
here?
I don't.
You don't know?
No. I can remember when they put a piece on it, 100 feet on the end. I can remember them building that.
Was this because they had more boats?
It was because to make the harbor more shelter, it put it, extended it out that far, and it made more room for the boats. But before my time, my father's time, no wharf here, and they had vessels. And when there came a storm in the winter, why, they had to go to Mushwash for a harbor, or St. John, or La Crow Harbor, or Beaver Harbor, wherever they could get to wait out the storm.
And what about the roads, John? When were they improved?
Well, the road that we have now was the first that it was upgraded, and 1928. The old road was just a horse and carriage road as far as I can remember back, but after they got some cars, more cars around, they had to have better roads, and they upgraded it then.
And it was surfaced or paved in...
Paved in 48, I think.
And do you remember when the telephone was put through?
Well, there was always a telephone, as far as I can remember, a public telephone down at Mr. Boyle's. That would be the last house down a road to the village at the wharf, and there was a public telephone there as far back as I can remember.
There wasn't any pilot service here when you were growing up then, like Harry Spears had a pilot?
Mr. Spears, his father, was a pilot, and he kept a boat here, and he went out of the harbor here and got aboard of, there was a lot of sailing vessels then, and he piloted them into St. John. And then I don't know just how he'd come back. I suppose he'd come back in his own boat if the weather was so that he could take his boat in with a ship. But I've known his son, Harry, to put him aboard the ships out here, and he would bring a boat in, a small boat, and then he would go to St. John in the car. And one day he done that, and he got his father aboard of two vessels in one day and piloted them in. Brought them back and took them out and put them on another vessel, and his son wasn't here all the time. That just happened to be son was home on his holidays. But the pilot boats, the main pilot boats, they harbored here quite a lot then. They would anchor over in the lee of what we call Fishing Point. And I remember them, they'd lay there and then they'd go out put a man aboard of a vessel or a steamboat or whichever it would be, and I would see two or three probably pilot boats laying there one day.
From the villages, or did they come from other places?
Well, them pilot boats, their headquarters was St. John. They were big, quite big vessels, much like, they were much like what they call the old fishing vessels out of Nova Scotia, which would be like the Blue Nose, only not that large, but they were on that line. They would be vessels, I would say, probably 75 and 80 feet long, two masts.
When Daniel Belding and Hugh Campbell came to their respective villages, they started a pilot service. They wouldn't have the large vessel, so they just have small sailing sloops.
They just had the small boats. Oh, these here vessels, each pilot boat had her number, and the number was on the sail. When the main sail was up, the number was on the sail.
Now, John, will you tell me what you remember about lobster fishing alone or with your father?
I first started lobster fishing with my father, and that was up at Tynemouth Creek.
Is that about St. John?
Yeah. I don't know just how far it would be, but up there probably, I suppose it would be 25 miles. St. John would it be by water? 20 anyway. Say 20.
Was the fishing better up there?
Well, in the spring it was better. That is, the lobster were bigger, and it wasn't fished so hard in the fall season, and in the spring, quite a lot of the men from down here went up on account of that.
When they went up, did they live aboard their boats?
Well, most built a camp and lived in it. Then, because their boats were small, fishing boats.
Did your father buy lobsters too?
Well, he did after after that a bit. I went up with him there, and he had different sailboats. So the one I went with them was a one-masted, what they called a sloop boat, called the Hilda. And from about 1922 until 28, we bought lobsters up there for Burpee Wilson in Eastport. And we would go into St. John on our way up and get gas parole for the fishermen up there and pick up any supplies that they needed like that, gasoline, and then we'd go on up and it would take the week practically to get around all the coves and one thing and another, go as far as Martin Head and pick up lobsters from each fisherman. And at night, if it was a fine night, we would anchor outside in some cove, and whatever lobsters we had for that part of the week, if maybe we got lobsters from seven or eight or 10 different fishermen, then we'd have probably ton of lobsters, and we would have to put them over and string them on a line, the crates, and each crate then an average of about 125 pounds of the crate. We'd put them over, and then if it stayed fine all night, in the morning, the first thing we had to do was to hoist them lobsters all aboard again, put them in the hole, and then start on for the next day, and probably we would not make it down and get everybody looked after that day. We'd have to do the same thing, and if the weather wasn't fit to stay out, we'd have to go in the high water harbor and ground the boat anywhere we could, and put the lobsters over for an hour or so while the tide was up, and drink them and put them back in again. And at the end of the week, we generally managed to get back down here at Dipper Harbor by Friday. And then we had to put all these lobsters over again. By that time, we'd have quite a few lobsters, maybe. Put them over and let them stay overnight. And the next morning, get them all back into the boat again and take them down to Eastport. And that was a day's journey there and back. And Monday morning, we started and done the same thing again. And that went on for 2 months. We'd start in doing that the 1st of April, and the season closed then, if I remember right, the 24th of May. And when the season closed, we would come home and get ready to go salmon fishing. We started salmon fishing as early in June as we could get ready for. And salmon fished until mid-July then. That was about as late as we fished. Then after the salmon fishing was over, we would go trawling, catch a hake mostly, and sold them in here to the fish buyers at the harbor here. And then some years, Father had a share in a weir here, and he'd have to go build weir, so some years I would, my brother and I would come up and fish. Then in the fall, and again, I'd go back with him again, that is my father, and up there buying those lobsters again for Mr. Wilson. And yeah, I kept doing that for about 7 years. And then the father sold the boat and bought another one. Had another one built over in Nova Scotia. And then that thing was getting pretty well over then. The trucks they were doing, the trucking was taking the lobsters to market then. Thing changed around. The last boat he had, he kept it 2 years and sold it to the St. John Dry Dock. That was 1931. Back to just fishing out of the home here after that.
Again, John, what are the dark waters of fishing?
The dark waters, I remembered or understood it, was the fresh water coming down from the mouth of the St. John River, a harbor on the ebb tide, and it would come down as far as Mushwash or Lorneville, depending on how the wind was. at that time, and then the salt water would, the flood tide would be backing it up, and it would make the streaks that would make, and they would be the dark water, and that's where you were more liable to get salmon in the daytime, was to run your nets close by them streaks on the dark water. The salmon didn't see the net then as good in the dark water as it did in the salt water, which was clearer.
When were you married, Joan?
Married in 1938.
And your wife was no stranger to this part?
She came from Sussex, and she down here teach school is where I met her.
And her name?
Her name was Grace Friars.
What did you do at that time? What work were you doing the time you married?
Well, at that time I was tending ware. My brother and I, Orville, was tending ware for Mr. Spears, the Molly Brown Ware it was called. We tended that together for 8 years, and had a very good season.
Where was the market then?
Well, we sold fish to both American factories and the Connor Brothers, Black Harbor. The market was good then in the war years, in the early 40s.
Now, you must have some memories told to you by the older people, John. Do any stand out in your mind?
Well, I had one that I can think of right now. It's an uncle of mine that lived in Little Mushbush. I didn't mention his name, his Uncle Gil Wynn. He telling us a great yarn teller, and this evening he telling us that one warm day in the summer he had rode down to Chance Harbor to the store to get some provisions, and among the things he got was a gallon of molasses. So on the way back he had set it in front of him where he was rowing. And the motion of the boat and the heat of the sun, it started to foam up around the cork. And he got interested in that, and every time he took a stroke and motioned back and forth, he would be near the jug and he would lick off the foam. And he got so interested in that, when he come to realize where he was, he had rowed by his own place, and he had to turn around and row back, which wasn't too good at the time because the tide was running again of then. But he made quite a joke of it anyway, and we had a laugh. And then there was another incident that the older people told me, my grandmother's time. They were living at the same location, Little Mushbush, and there was different families located along there, Murrays and Mangans, and more than that probably, but them are just the few that I think of at the time and mention. But the men, their husbands, I've heard them tell this yarn that they would be sitting on a log, maybe down on the beach or the bankhead in the evening, and smoking their pipe and whittling or whatever and talking among themselves, and one would say to the other, "The women will have a fine evening to row home from St. John." And they'd say, "Yes, they would." And why they were up there rowing home was that they took the dulse or whatever they had, probably some berries or whatever, up to sell in St. John. And the reason the women went, they couldn't trust their husbands to go because they probably would spend the money. They would like maybe to get a few drinks or something. And so that's the way they made a living, is working. The women worked, it seemed, as much as the men.
Well, they certainly had the pioneer spirit. How many miles would that be?
From Little Mushquash, I would say, somewhere between 12 and 14 miles by water.
That would be one way.
Yeah, one way.
That's quite a feat, really.
Yes, it was. Well, I suppose they had sails on them boats at that time, and if the women, I guess, were as capable of sailing the boat as the men, and if they had a fair enough wind, they would sail some, too.
That quite upsets my past stories. I thought women just worked in the house, John.
Well, today they do, that is. Then they had to get out and do whatever they could to make the extra dollar.
Yeah.
And probably their housework wasn't as extensive. I suppose they had no vacuum cleaners or electricity or anything like that. It was more or less of a rough job that was done. And the main thing was to get something to eat. Have a warm, comfortable bed, I guess.
And like people today, I suppose, to try to pass on a better way to your children.
Oh yes, that's the idea.
John, I believe he was caught in a rope one time while you were unloading herring.
Yes, we were taking fish from here in the winter time down to Eastport, and this one time in particular, it was quite a cold night. We always went down in the night because them fish was drove here, and that had to be done at night, and probably we wouldn't get away till midnight or so, and this night, it was quite a cold night, and they get down there. Father and I take turns steering, and I had on last one to steer, and I had on this heavy sheepskin coat. When we got into the dock, the tide was too low to take the fish out, so he wanted to get them out in a hurry to ship them. And took us up to another dock where we could get in a little better. And they were heisting the fish with a truck and a single rope through a block and tie it on the truck and then back the truck up, and that would haul up the tub of fish. So after it got started, the boat was laying off from the wharf about, I would say 10 feet, and I was tending the tub when it came out of the hole and had a line to keep it from going in again the wharf hard. And I had so many clothes on that I walked back to the cabin way and took off the heavy coat I'd on, and when I come back to take a hold of the rope again, and my foot got caught in the rope, and I was flipped right off the deck quick, and heisted me up to the top of the wharf, and they were afraid that I might get untangled from the way I was hooked if they started to take me in up there, so they decided they'd lower me back, and they lowered me back till the tub was in the water, and then I was in the water down underneath it, and I came up and got a hold of the tub of fish, and the man that was aboard the boat scooping the fish, he got the pipe pole and held it over to me and got me hauled over and got me hauled aboard of the boat after a struggle. And I had to take off my clothes then, and down in the cabin where there was a good coal fire on, and get in the bunk and stay there till my father come back. He had gone to the custom house. When he come back, he had to go back uptown and buy me a new outfit of clothes before I could go back to work. And the owner of the fellow that was buying the fish, he come down and wanted to know if I was hurt. He'd take me up to the doctor, but I told him no, I wasn't hurt that bad. So I got back to work again, and we come home, and that was one event that I had there that I was lucky enough to come out of without getting killed or drowned, whichever one.
Yes, or even a leg broken with a rope around it.
Yeah.
What about taxes in the place, John? How were they collected?
Well, the school taxes was collected by the secretary of the school, and the county taxes there was someone appointed to collect them, as I remember. In my time, there was a man from Mushquoise that collected, Mr. Wynn, collected taxes for a time, and after that, I just don't remember about, but the school taxes was always whoever was secretary collected.
Were the taxes very large then on properties?
Well, no, they were high enough for money was harder to come by, and taxes weren't, because the properties then weren't as valuable as today, they didn't have the facilities that they got.
And what about elections then? Were they lively?
Well, sometimes they were quite a lively affair when especially, I guess, when they come to the end of the day and the votes was counted, then whoever got in, they made quite a time and had bonfires and crowd gathered around, cheered.
Any liquor flowing, John?
Well, I can't remember. I suppose there was, but I was too young to. But I think that was always a more or less of a part in it. Whoever won treated their
real celebration. What about Indians, John? I know there's Indians here. And do you know what tribe they belong to? Maliseet or Mi'kmaq?
I couldn't tell you that, Ethel. But there was Indians came up from down the shore somewhere, I think around Quoddy River, and they had a camp over at the western side of Point La Pro there. It was called Big Cove, and they would go out in their canoes and shoot porpoise out and Point La Pro streak there where the tides would turn, and them porpoise would play there, and they shoot a porpoise, and they must have been pretty quick, for they could get that porpoise before he sank and I often wondered how they got them in the canoe, but I fished one time with Willie Thompson, and I asked him about that, talking about Indians, for he lived down handier to them than I did, and he told me the way they got them into the canoe, they caught them by the tail and pumped them up and down until they got them so they would come out of the water pretty good, and then they flipped them into the canoe, which was quite a feat.
Yes, I suppose. About how much would a porpoise weigh?
Well, I think a porpoise could weigh 200 pounds.
That weight would be easy to flip a canoe.
Yes, it would, yes.
Did you know any of the Indians?
One of them, one time, Joe Newell. He came home one evening with an uncle and his daughter, an uncle of mine and my uncle's daughter, and Mr. Newell was quite a violin player, and he played the violin, and my uncle's daughter, she played the piano, and he had quite a good rendition of different tunes and so on.
Can you remember any of the tunes they played?
Well, no, I can't, you know, but they seem to be quite enjoyable. The evening was spent, and I never had any, you know, personal talk with the Indians myself. For that time, I was fairly young when they were around.
And they just came for seasons and then moved on?
Oh, they would come up there maybe and stay like maybe 2 or 3 weeks or a month in the camp and then go back again.
And would the camp be there for the next time they came?
Yeah, the camp was there, and I think likely today, if I went down there, I could show you right where the camp was.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. Was it built like a log cabin, the way they built?
No, it was, one I remember was built out of boards. I think there was quite a lot of material come ashore on the beaches then, and they could pick up enough stuff there, right there, for to shape up a camp for to stay in the summertime for, and then I guess some of them had their tent with them. And set their tent.
John, I believe you had a boat with a pinky stern. Would you tell me about
it? Yes, I had one that was left to me when my father died. It was the last sailboat that he had. And they were, well, different sizes, but this one was, I think, in the vicinity of somewhere between 42 and 45 feet long, one mast, sail and jib, and an engine in it, if you wanted to use it. And they carried fish in them, sardines at one time, quite a lot. This one would carry, well, 25 hogs, I guess, was the capacity.
Would it take from the weirs at that time?
Oh, yeah. And I didn't have any use for it, so I had it probably 2 or 3 years after that, and I sold it to Captain Alexander. Then I think he was retired then at the time, lived in St. John. He was a Scotchman. So I sold it to him, and he had it for, well, mostly just playing around in. He bought some fish for fox feed, and one thing or another like that. And that was the last that I knew of that boat.
Why did they say it had a pinky stern?
Well, it was sharp, and the stern part was brought in pretty sharp, and that had a slope, quite a slope, and the rudder hung on that, and you steered it with a tiller instead of a wheel.
Did this give it more speed?
Well, I don't think. I think the reason they built them that way, they were easier boat built. The stern, there wasn't so much sharp bend to the plank and one thing and another.
And then there's another boat they talk about, a nigger heel stern. John,
yes,
what's that like?
I had a nigger heel and fished in it quite a little while. It was built in Tiverton, Nova Scotia. And they were a slope and stern, kind of raked back. It made them a longer boat on the waterline than the ordinary boat. They were longer on the waterline than they were on the actual top of the boat. But it was a good boat. It was a good sea boat.
And it was the last nigger heel boat?
It was the last one that was here, I think.
Where did it go from here?
Well, I condemned it myself when I had a new boat built.
It's not being seaworthy, is that it?
Yeah.
John, would you tell me about the time you caught a shark in your weir?
Yes, I caught a shark. Well, we didn't actually get him out, but the weir caught the shark, and it was in the weir when we went in the morning to check for fish. And when we were rowing around to feel the weir, see if there's any fish in it, they could see this down quite deep, just get a glance of it once in a while to know that it was a big fish of some sort. So that, when the afternoon, when the tide suited to seine the weir, we did that. There was some sardines there too, but the shark bit in the seine, and it was big, and it tore our seine, tore it awful bad, and we lost the shark out of the seine eventually, but it was still in the weir. So we went and got another old seine that we didn't care much about, and we seined it again, and we had him that time up alongside the boat, and was starting to tow it out. And I know the shark was at least 25 feet, it must have been, because the boat we were working out of was 32 feet long, and we had the shark up alongside of it. And going by that, I know that the shark was somewhere near that length. And the tail across the fins of the tail of it, the spread, the other boys that was with me, Delbert Tyner and Ralph Mooney, we thought that it must have spread across at least 9-10 feet on the tail, because we tried to lasso a line over the tail of it and we couldn't get it over because it was such a spread.
Tremendous.
Yeah.
Where would it come from?
Well, I don't know. That was over the weekend. See, we had never been to Weir from Saturday morning, and this was Monday morning. And when he left us and we was through with him, I don't know how he made out, because I know he had only one eye left, because the second time we had him up close, Delbert took the pipe pole, which is sharp in one end, and drove it into his eye.
Is that right? But he left, it was still alive when
yeah.
he left your weir.
Oh, yes. So,
about how much would a shark like that weigh?
Oh, I haven't any idea. It was, I would think it weighed a ton, fish that big.
Was there any herring in the weir?
Oh, yeah, there was some, but nothing, no big amount. There might have been two or three hogs.
Yes.
They wouldn't go in there with that big fish swimming around.
What's the most herring you've ever seen out of a weir?
Well, at one time, I think it was 90 hogs. took out in the one tide.
Yes.
That was Orville and I at Molly Brown Weir.
Would one boat take that many?
No, there was three boats. They, you know, they weren't probably taking a full load, if I remembered right. The one fella took 35 hogs and so on like that. And the last fella, he cleaned the seine out 17, if I remember right. And it, anyway, it added up 90 hogs. And that after the next tide, we went back and seined the weir again, for we knew there was more fish in her, and we took out 18 hogs the same day on the second tide.
That's a lot of fish.
Yeah. It was the best that I ever out of a weir.
They say there are feed and fish at times. John, what is feed?
Well, I...
It's a plankton they eat, is it?
It's, they eat the substance they must eat out of the water, and you find it in the stomach of the fish, and it's just a hard kernel, like mostly, it's, I wouldn't say altogether hard, but it'll come out just in a shape almost like as if it was a piece of carrot or about that color. And
it makes them perishable, or?
Well, they, when they take them to the factory to clean them and or cook them, they don't stand up as good. The stomachs break open quicker with that feed in them. It don't spoil the fish any, but if you have fish with feed in them, you've got to keep them until they clear that out of their system before you can sell them.
How long does it take to clear the food or feed out of them?
Well, it sometimes it'll clear out quick. It all depends an awful lot of the time, if I remembered right, how the wind is. If the wind is onshore, the feed will clear up quicker